like am able to stay so calm is that my developmental expectations for my children is that they are going to be done at this point. And I knew that anything, expecting anything more than that would be beyond what they are actually capable of doing, because they have the attention span of like, I don't know, 12 minutes, my four-year-old maybe, and then he's done. And so like, I can't expect them to develop or mature just so I can shop longer. And then the second thing is back to that emotional thing. My emotions are mine. My kids can't make me feel a certain way. I need to detach that. And that takes work. That takes time. That is something someone commented on here. I've only started to really learn this with parenthood. And I absolutely believe that, like, as a parent, I realize I need to be in control of my emotions, because when I start getting stressed, when I have a need that's not getting met, when I, you know, have these missing skills, I have to work on that myself, and I can't put that on my children. So obviously that's hard sometimes. Like if I have a lot of triggers going on, my kids are screaming, it's hard, like rolling down the window, calming down, that kind of thing. But if you practice it, and if you prepare yourself for it, and if you know the developmental expectations, you can take a deep breath, you can do like whatever meditation, try to be silly, calm the chaos. But having that ownership and control of your own emotions, I think, is the biggest thing that helps me in those situations. Because
what's my name? What's my name? What's my name?
All right. Hi, I'm Lauren Pace. I have the handle XO Lauren Pace over on Instagram, and I am a mom of two. I used to be a preschool teacher. And then when I was like 38 weeks pregnant with my son, I quit my job, started grad school, studied behavior, and since have become like a behavior coach, development specialist. And I was doing consulting in classrooms, in homes, and now mostly I just do it online. I do online classes through my podcast, social media, and Zoom calls and things like this. I just love connecting with people like all over the world and spreading the message of positive parenting and just ways to understand children's behavior differently than most people understand it currently.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, I'm Mr. Chaz for those who don't know me, but if you're listening or you're here right now, I have a sneaking suspicion that you do. So I'm not going to spend really much of any time on me, but if you would like to, if you're listening to this in the future on Spotify, Google, wherever, iHeartRadio, I do this podcast live 7 p.m. Eastern on through the Get Vocal, getvocal.com/Chaz. And you can show up 7 p.m. Eastern and get asked questions to me, to my guests, and then we can have a grand old time. I see more and more people are joining the room. So we're going to go ahead and get started. And today we're talking about power struggles. And I love how Lauren, you know, started off talking about, you know, understanding behavior, because that's where it all really starts. And I've started to kind of, you know, formulate like a phrase that I think is kind of fits what, you know, I try to help parents and teachers and nannies, anyone who really interacts with children. And it's three words: see, guide, trust. First, you know, the focus is always really trying to understand the behavior, the child, the children, and really truly see them. And then once we see them, like really see them, genuinely see them, genuinely hear them, then we're much able to, much better able to guide them. And the way that we guide them will very much depend on, you know, how we see them. Whether you're really truly seeing them or not, how you guide them will impact see them will impact the way that you guide them. And then trust. And trust is about really trusting, you know, what you're doing, trusting yourself, trusting your children, and trusting the strategy and trusting that, you know, this is a learning process and things aren't always going to go perfectly. And I think it's really fitting. I was just thinking about this today to talk about power struggles, and this conversation fits into it, because when I ask parents, you know, like, you know, what is your goal? You know, describe the kind of parent you want to be. You know, I always, you know, say something along the lines of, I want to grow them to be a competent, you know, productive member of society. You know, emotional intelligence or emotional health kind of plays a part into it. And everyone has their different words, but that's you know, it's all about helping the child grow and learn and to be, you know, to grow into a, you know, productive, competent, emotionally healthy person. But then when we ask and then we get a little deeper into it, I'm like, okay, so like, you know, what do you need help with? A lot of times, especially when it comes to power struggles or temper tantrums, the conversation is like, well, how do I just eliminate, you know, power struggles? How do I just eliminate temper tantrums? How do I almost sometimes even eliminate the struggle or eliminate the emotions? And that always goes into a very interesting conversation because, you know, a lot of those times that we that are really struggling, that we really struggle with as adults, you know, being with children, a lot of those times that we struggle with are essential for their growth. They're important for their growth. So I'm going to go ahead and shut up for a little bit and ask Lauren questions. Before I, you know, go on to more rants, but we're gonna start off just like since we're talking about power struggles, let's first just define like what is a power struggle. You know, let's see power struggles. Like, you know, Lauren, how would you define a power? Like, what are, you know, what are we talking about when we say power struggles?
Okay, so when you look at like a parent and child situation, both are trying to quote unquote win the situation. They both want their way. So power struggles happen when we expect full compliance from our child and our child wants independence. So our child has this need they're trying to communicate. They want independence or they're trying to develop their sense of autonomy and that kind of thing. And if we just say, no, it's my way or the highway, we're missing this opportunity to support them in growing that independence and having like a productive way of communicating that independence.
Yeah. Okay. So and then you kind of went into like already where what I was going to ask next about like, what does it mean? And, you know, you're talking about they're trying to find their independence, their autonomy. Now, how do we support that? And, you know, they and children, especially I see over on the side talking, you know, my favorite topic for toddler parents. Sometimes us adults, parents, teachers, nannies, We just need to get things done. Like we just need to make it to our appointment on time. Sometimes there's not a choice. You know, like how do we navigate that situation? You know, how do we like talk a little bit more about how do we navigate it with our very with what we want, right? Because our toddler, our child may want something and something that we want is very different. How do we communicate? How do we, you know, meet in the middle? How do we compromise? Should we compromise?
Yeah. Okay. So this is really good. And I think like, I don't want to overlap with some of the other questions that I know that you have ahead of time. Like I have an experience with my daughter I'm going to share, stuff like that. But I think one of the biggest things is trying to figure out what they're communicating with their struggle. And sometimes we can't do that right in the moment. But if every single day we say, okay, it's time to put your shoes on. And they're like, no, I'm not putting my shoes on. What is it about putting their shoes on or how you phrase that question that they're like fighting you on? Or like, okay, it's time to get dressed. And every single day it's a power struggle because you want them to get dressed and they don't want to get dressed. Is it because they don't know how to do it? Is it because they, my son did this like every day of toddlerhood. He would not get dressed. And so some of the things that you realize is part of them is developing independence, but also another part of them is they're developing a sense of self. They're trying to push the boundaries to see where they kind of fit in the world. And also to see what happens. Like if I don't get dressed, what's going to happen? Or maybe they just don't like their clothes. They'd rather be in pajamas because of a sensory need. So if we can get to the reason why they are resisting a certain struggle, then we can better understand like how to address it. So if it's because they want independence, then let's offer them choices so that they still have two different choices that they can choose from. Oh, like today we are going to go to school just like any other day. But in the car, do you want to listen to Elsa or do you want to listen to Tarzan? We give them two options where either way we're going into the car, but they have some independence and freedom and choices. Well, and also it goes back to like our first conversations that we had. Me and Mr. Chaz, when he was on my podcast, we talked about, it was right after the riots, and we talked about how we want our children to be able to voice their opinions in the world and to have a way to like express themselves. But sometimes like the classrooms aren't set up for that. And like you try to argue with the teacher and they say, oh no, like you will listen to me. I'm the adult. And there's no compromise. And so I absolutely do think that we as adults need to make room for negotiation, need to make room for compromise. Sometimes we have to say no for the safety of our child. But most of the time, there is room for them to have a choice within what we're asking them to do. So either way, they have to get in the car, but there's always choices for how you get to the car, how you climb in the car, what, you know, song you want to send in the car. There's so many choices you can give them to give them this freedom and this autonomy and independence while they're still getting that need met that you need them to do.
Right. And, you know, I always say that they may not be able to make the big overall choice, but there are very likely little choices that they can make within that big choice that they would be very excited to make. Now, you also mentioned, you know, pushing boundaries, that sometimes they will, a power struggle will start because they want to see what's going to happen if I don't put on my shoes or what's going to happen if I don't put on my jammies. Like, so in that situation, you know, what do we do if they're doing it to push boundaries, if they're doing it to see what's going to happen, how you're going to respond?
Okay. I like this. So, I teach like a listening conference. It's like 4 different days based on 4 different like functions of behavior. So one is like they're trying to do a power struggle where they just like need choices, they need independence. And then one is they're just pushing the boundaries. And on that day, I talk about how if the function of their behavior, if they're trying to communicate that they want to see what you're going to do, then you have to be consistent with what you said you were going to do. So if you say, okay, if you don't put your shoes on, then I'm just going to leave you here, then you have to leave them there. So don't say that, right? You're like, where is she going with this? No, if you say these empty threats where you're just like, okay, fine, I'm going to leave you home, but you can't actually leave them home, then guess what? They just won that power struggle or whatever that battle because they're like, oh, mom's not really going to do that. So instead you can say, okay, you can put your shoes on or mom's going to have to help you put your shoes on. What's your choice? And then you wait. They don't choose. Okay, you help them. That means you're putting their shoes on them. But you never just say, okay, mom's going to leave and hope it works because you cannot actually follow through with that. It's not safe. And so therefore, they win. They tested the boundary. They're like, mom's not serious. I can get away with a lot more because she doesn't know what she's doing.
Right. And then also, it starts to erode the trust, right?
Too, yeah.
Because now mom will just say, or dad, or whoever it is, will just say, whatever. And I don't even know if it's true because they're just saying whatever to meet their agenda. And it may, and then when you are saying something that's true that you'll do, like they're still not sure if, you know, you're telling the truth. So it actually erodes the trust. And you want, you know, children to be, you want children to know that when you say something, you that it's true. Yes.
And right. you want the consequence to match their action. So yeah. If they're not putting on their shoes, okay, you're not going to leave them home. That's a horrible thing. But like when I was a preschool teacher, there were some kids who made some like unsafe choices in the classroom and they were hurting other children. I said, okay, if we continue to do that, you're not making safe choices. So you're not going to be able to go on this field trip with us because if we can't be safe in the classroom, then we can't be safe on the school bus. And like one time I actually had to follow through with that to teach them, if you're not safe in the classroom, you don't get to come. They never, ever, ever did that again because they realized, oh, I'm serious. And also, if I'm not safe in school, then I can't do these fun things. And so it just kind of matched the consequence better.
Yeah, no, for sure. And there's definitely always in a classroom, there's definitely at least, well, especially if you have at least 10 kids or even say 8 kids, there's always at least one who's going to want to push the boundary. And one thing that I always kind of something just kind of help people think about, you know, why children push boundaries, why people push boundaries is, you know, when you know, think about when you go on a roller coaster. Are you a roller coaster person? Lauren, have you ever been on a roller coaster?
Don't love them. I like the up and down ones, but I don't like the loop-de-loop. No way.
Okay. But you've been on them before, right? Yeah. And so when people first get on, and you know, next time, whenever amusement parks do open for, you know, most people, I know Disney World's open with it. Anyways, that's another, you know, rant. But when people first get on the roller coaster and the person puts the seatbelt down, the first thing that most people do is they push against just to see where that boundary is and just to see that they're safe in that boundary. And that's how, you know, that's my, you know, metaphor for what children are doing. They push just to see where the boundary is. I'm like, okay, I'm safe. This is the boundary. This is what it is. But they have to push to see. We know, even if we know that, okay, I've been on roller coasters hundreds of times before, it snapped, it locked, but let me just make sure. And so for children who are learning about boundaries, and you know, this is, and especially in toddlerhood when it's the first time maybe where we are really talking about boundaries, because they have, they're gaining so much more ability to do so many, you know, they're not just crawling anymore. They're getting up, they're walking, they're running, they're jumping, they're climbing, starting to use words. Then, you know, that's when we really start to, you know, have to create more boundaries, but it's very natural for them to push up against it. So that's something that we should expect. And I think if it's something that we expect, then it won't frustrate us as much when it happens.
And I think that's a good point too. Like when we get in the roller coaster and we feel that boundaries there, we're like, oh, I feel safe. Kids who are pushing the boundary don't necessarily want us to get rid of that boundary. Sometimes they're testing to see, is this classroom safe for me? If somebody does this to me, what is the teacher going to do? And they're kind of testing all of that out when they push the boundaries.
Yeah, for sure. I think you mentioned two other reasons for power struggles. I know you said independence, and what we do if the function or the reason for them, for the power struggle is independence, they're trying to assert independence, then you want to give them choices. If they're, you know, trying to push boundaries, you want to follow through and make sure you're not giving empty threats. What were the other two that you mentioned?
Well, autonomy goes with independence, and then curiosity can go with the pushing of the boundaries as well, I think. And figuring out sense of self, I think, also goes into pushing the boundaries, just to see what happens and kind of where they fit in, like, this classroom. Are they safe? That kind of thing. I do have one more. I was going to talk about it. But sometimes we get in power struggles because we give away our power to our children by not claiming our own emotional power. Okay, let me explain that.
Okay. Yep,
so if I say to my child, oh, you're making me so angry, that's telling my child they're making me feel a certain way. And so then my child's like, well, if I can make them feel angry, I can make them feel this. I can make them feel this. I can make them feel this. So if we give away our power to our children, then we have to fight to get it back, because they're just going to keep going and going and going. It's like, I'm driving mom crazy. How can I be annoying in other ways to really make her lose it? Or, yeah, you know, as a preschool teacher. So we have to take control and ownership of our own emotions. I'm feeling really frustrated right now. I could say something like that, or I'm feeling really angry right now. I need a minute to go calm down. That is so much different than saying you're making me angry, because then it encourages them to be like, oh, I'm going to make her more angry. Or it could also have an effect where it's like making the child feel guilty and have internal struggles that they've made their parent feel a certain way. The way we feel as parents has nothing to do with our kids.
Yeah. And I always say that it's, you know, children can't make you angry. It's not the children that make you angry. It's your interpretation of their behavior that makes you angry. And when we start really seeing it like that, and we start seeing how we're interpreting what's going on and where that's really coming from, then I think that's a way to take your power back, and to see that you do have full power over your emotions. And maybe it's some work that we have to do, you know, in growing. And that's a great thing about children. Children will force you to grow. And if you're not learning and if you're not growing with them, then that's when the frustration does become overwhelming because then you're unable to meet the challenge. But yes, I love it. So choices, follow through. I love what you said about, you mentioned curiosity. And I think I would also add, a lot of times it is us having unrealistic expectations of where they're at developmentally. If you are saying that, your toddler, your expectation for your toddler is to stand somewhere quietly and not touch anything, and then when they are, touching things and they're moving around and they're doing things that toddlers do, then you try to exert more power. No, I said sit right here. How many times do I have to tell you? Sometimes we create the power struggle because we're not really clear on what they are developmentally ready to do. And by the way, it's not necessarily just an age group, right? Because we know that children are developmentally in different places and, different ages, different, and not even fully, cognitively a child can be a little advanced or maybe a little ahead, but maybe emotionally and socially he or she's a little bit behind. And so really being really, and that's what I talked about in the beginning, really seeing your child where they're at developmentally and what they're ready for, I think is also another way to avoid power struggles or not put yourself into a power struggle.
Absolutely. That actually is a thought I had for another question you had of like how I stay calm during power struggles.
You know what, Lauren? I know I had like questions, but just feel free to that's just kind of the framework. Feel free to say things as you feel them.
Okay, in that case, I'm going to tell a funny story. Okay, so the other day, like 2 days ago, I was at an outdoor market with my two kids. My kids are 4 and 2, and I knew going into it that they were going to be done after like 1 hour. We stayed for 3, okay? So I knew going into it that they were going to be done. That's my developmental expectation. I knew they were going to be done. But I bought them a stupid $5 balloon. I was like, oh, wow, look at this. Lots of redirection, lots of like just different strategies that, I can just pull out of my hat to try to get them to last longer so I can shop.
Yeah.
We sit down to have lunch and I'm with my friend. She's across the table from me. She also has a 2-year-old. Both of our 2-year-olds were ready for their nap. And then like this bee shows up. My friend's trying to tell me this story and this like honeybee shows up and I'm like, oh, it's okay. It's just a honeybee. It's okay. And my daughter's crying. I'm like, it's okay, honey. I'll take a sting for you. It's going to be fine. Then the honeybee goes over to her 2-year-old and this mom starts freaking out. She's yelling. She's like, sit down right now. Like, we're going home. You need to sit down. You're going to get, anyway, she starts freaking out. And then everything her toddler did after that, she just was like, like stress level, like 100. I was just like, just kind of smiling and laughing. And there was like 10 minutes of this. We're trying to eat lunch, get through my friend's story. The kids keep interrupting. And I just kept saying, oh, here, try this. Do, 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 do. And she looks at me and she's like, how are you staying so calm? And I was like, I like thought about it for a minute because like I had just watched her kid for a minute while she got in line to get us corn dogs. And her kid was like licking like under the table. Gross, right? Anyway, I like look over at her mom, like,
2-year-old
off the table. She's like, I like how I leave her with a child development expert and you let her do whatever she wants. Like, ew, I can't control her. Anyways, but what I thought about of like why I just like am able to stay so calm is that my developmental expectations for my children is that they are going to be done at this point. And I knew that expecting anything more than that would be beyond what they are actually capable of doing because they have the attention span of like, I don't know, 12 minutes, my 4-year-old maybe, and then he's done. And so like, I can't expect them to develop or mature just so I can shop longer. And then the second thing is back to that emotional thing. My emotions are mine. My kids can't make me feel a certain way. I need to detach that. And that takes work. That takes time. That is something someone commented on here. I've only started to really learn this with parenthood. And I absolutely believe that, like, as a parent, I realize I need to be in control of my emotions, because when I start getting stressed, when I have a need that's not getting met, when I, you know, have these missing skills, I have to work on that myself, and I can't put that on my children. So obviously that's hard sometimes. Like, if I have a lot of triggers going on, my kids are screaming, it's hard, like rolling down the window, calming down, that kind of thing. But if you practice it, and if you prepare yourself for it, and if you know the developmental expectations, you can take a deep breath, you can do like whatever meditation, try to be silly, calm the chaos. But having that ownership and control of your own emotions, I think, is the biggest thing that helps me in those situations, because I know it's going to happen. And then, okay, it's okay. They can be grumpy, whatever. I can still have a good time. They can be screaming. My daughter can be screaming for me in the middle of the night. I take a deep breath. I go in there, say, "Hey, sis, it's okay." Or whatever. I could go and be like, "Stop crying every night," you know. But if we can get in control of our own emotions, I think that really helps us stay calm when our kids are trying to resist or do a power struggle with us.
Yeah. You know, and I have something, it's a thought that I just had, kind of as you were talking. I'm like, well, you know, I definitely know what it's like to feel frustrated, and I definitely have not always kept my cool in every situation.
Oh, absolutely not.
But I've definitely learned so much and have grown so much over the years. And, you know, something that I do that I don't think I've ever really heard anyone else say that they do, but I'm going to share it. Maybe it might help someone else. Maybe it's just a quirk that I have. I use, like, you know, breathing, and definitely think about, you know, where children are developmentally. But a lot of times when things are going on, sometimes it's like thing after thing after thing after thing after thing. And it's like, okay, like, if it was just one thing, like if it was just that someone pulled the plug on the water table and now, you know, 5 gallons of water on the floor, if it was just that, you know, a child had an accident and thrown, you know, poop on the wall and was doing poop paint with it. If it was that a child, right. It was just that a child, you know, got hit in the head with a blind, which is one of those things. All right, fine. But sometimes when it's all those things happening at the same time, you know,
it can scream.
Yes. And so what one of the things that I do, you know, besides the, I've talked about in the past of, like, you know, taking 10 seconds of breathing, whatever, and just, you know, but something else that I do, like, probably like right in the moment, is that, like, I almost take myself, and I guess it's kind of similar to the breathing, but it's, I almost take myself out of my body and kind of like look at it as if it's like a movie, almost like watching a movie, and kind of laugh.
Like, I would laugh if I did that.
Yeah, right. And like, if I was watching my life on a movie, or watching that, you know, scene in a movie, I'd be laughing right now. And it's almost kind of like, you know, you remember the movie Daddy Daycare?
Yeah.
The trailer where I think it was Eddie Murphy, right? I think it was the movie. I think his name. When he's walking into the it might not have been him, but it was someone. But it was a black dad. But I don't remember who it was. But he was walking into the bathroom and he was like. And there's like poop on your ceiling. Like, on the outside, like, that's funny.
Yeah.
But like, when you're in that moment, it's like, what the, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's something that I think I've kind of just taught myself to do. I don't know if that's gonna help anyone else. It may not help.
I'm kind of a dark humor type of person. Like, I look at things and then like someone will tell me a really terrible story and I'll start laughing. I'll be like, one day that's going to be really funny to you. Like, it's not right now, but one day that's going to be really funny to you.
Yeah.
One of the things we did at one of the daycares I worked at forever ago was we would write down funny things like kids did, or like terrible things kids did, but turned out to be funny. And we had this whole bulletin board in the break room. We used like code names, but we just put all these stories up so we could just go in there and just like read everybody else's.
And you know what? I do know, though, that humor is a very emotionally healthy way to deal with, you know, some of those things. So I do think that it is, you know, I think it'll at least help one person out there who's listening, hopefully, just, you know, try to think of it as like, you know, what if it were a movie, and kind of almost taking yourself out of it because it's not personal. These things aren't, you know, an attack on you. And yeah, when you look back at it, and more times than not, we do end up looking back on it and laughing about it. And whether it's, you know, a week from now or months or years or when they get older, like, like you pooped your pants and, you know, X, Y, Z. And you're in the middle of the grocery store and you like just, you know, like in the moment, it's really tough and it's really frustrating. But if we can, you know, it's gaining perspective, really. And so that's just, you know, on how to, you know, maybe that might help someone to stay calm. Yes, the breathing may help. And I think everyone kind of needs their own thing.
Yeah.
That is specific to them. Because maybe not everyone has dark humor.
True. Okay, Nicole just asked a question, or not really a question, but I've been struggling when it is pushing a safety boundary. My child keeps repeating unsafe behavior and it is tiring. Would you consider that, Chaz, a power struggle?
I mean, so I would have to know more about the situation, but just from the information I have here, I wouldn't say it's a power struggle. Just from the information that I have here, it may be, if I had to guess, it may be in a physical response to an emotional reaction that your child is having. And that is the way that they're, and that's the way that they're expressing it. Or maybe that, you know, maybe it's a get away from me, or maybe it's, I want that toy. You know, and
okay, so
now she's mentioning, she tries to run into the street and refuses to hold her hand, offer it, holding, you know, holding a hand or going in the stroller. And she's 4 years old. Now I think that is not that, now that sounds like getting closer into the realm of power struggles for sure. Would you like to, you know, talk about, is that something that you have dealt with with your children? You talk about how you handle it. And before you go into it, I would just like to preface this with saying that, and we might be derailed just a little bit, but I actually want, just because it's been popping on my social media lately and I haven't had the time to really respond or make much more content. So I kind of want to talk about here. A lot of people, so I do edit a video where someone was made a brilliant song about, you know, stop hitting kids. And I don't know, did you see that?
Yeah, I shared it. That was so good.
Yeah, that was a really good, you know, that was a great song. Celebrity Kid, I think is his name. But anyways, there are people, very minority of people, but there are people in the comments who were like, well, if my child is running into the street or trying to, I think someone said something along the lines of like, you know, I think someone said, you know, I told my child not to play on the train tracks, and I caught them playing on the train tracks, so I beat the living blank out of them. And I think that's one of the more extreme comments. But then there were less extreme comments that were saying, I think this might even been on Instagram too, and I just haven't had a chance to reply. You know, just saying that, you know, I think that hitting might be good if it's out of safety, that I think that hitting my child, and their logic is that hitting or spanking my child is better than them potentially, you know, running into the street or doing something else unsafe. And so I would like to, you know, Nicole didn't mention like spanking or hitting her child or anything like that, but I would like for you to, you know, kind of talk about what Nicole is specifically about, like how to handle what to do in those situations when you are going across the parking lot and they don't want to hold your hand. I have some pretty, and I'll chime in too after that. But I always let my guests go first. And then after, I would like for you to speak to I spank my child so that they don't, you know, run, so that they associate running in the street with fear. And that's really what it is. And that's really what the comments had identified. And I will chime in too, because I have some very strong feelings and thoughts on that, but I'd like for you to go first. Oh, Lauren froze. Oh no. I don't know if she, so I don't know if one, if you can hear me or not, just log out and then log back in, if that works. And I will, okay, she's about to do it. And I know my rant is gonna take a while, but here's the punchline.
Am I back? Mom?
Yeah, you're back.
Okay, good.
Okay.
Okay. So what I was saying is corporal punishment is still allowed in 13 states. Teachers can still hit kids in 13 states in 2020. Are you freaking kidding me? Teachers, not parents, teachers. Okay, so that's my own problem. But yeah, well, actually that was 2019 stats. So maybe it's changed, but I doubt it. Okay, so back to the original problem, and then I'll talk about the spanking. So, 4-year-old not staying safe in the street. So something that I like to use in my wording, just like with my kids, is if you're making the choice to not keep your body safe, then you're choosing to, and then it's right in the wagon, right in the stroller, not go to the park today. Like, you can up your consequences as, you know, if they're doing it every time, maybe they don't get to go to the park. They have to stay in the backyard now or whatever it is. But I always use the wording, if you're making the choice to do this, then you're choosing to do this. So it's not me doing it to them. It's them making that choice. And then this is the consequence. And Chaz obviously agrees because he's nodding his head on that one. But the other thing I just want to say is when we spank our kids or beat the living whatever out of our kids when they're on the railroad track or whatever, that we're our function of behavior is we are afraid for our child. So the way we're communicating that is reacting and physically hitting them when we could sit them down, sternly tell them, we are so scared when you do that, and here's why. And you have this opportunity to teach them and express your feelings rather than scare them into submission, where you can have this open conversation. Here's my fears. Here's why I don't like you playing on the railroad track. If they don't get that, then read a book about a kid who died, or, you know, like take it to the next level so they understand your fear without you hurting them.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you are hitting your child, I know the goal is, you know, at least per the comments. And I very much know, even just per conversations I've had with many of people, the goal is trying to make the child associate the street with fear. And what ends up really happening is the child just associating you with fear. And so, and that causes them to shut down and so many other problems.
Psychological problems. It ruins that trust. And likely, if you're there, they're not going to do it because they're afraid of you. But if you're not there, they're still going to do it because they're not afraid of the railroad track. They're afraid of you.
Right. You haven't taught them anything. The only thing you've really taught them is to be afraid of you. And so, you know, especially as they're growing and as they're trying to figure out what the function or the reasons behind their behavior, why they're doing what they're doing, and they are developing their ability to talk, they won't talk to you because they don't trust you enough to do that. And so as you're trying to help them through other things, it is just, they'll be more shut down. And so maybe it's something that happens at school they won't tell you about, or maybe it's something that is happening even in your own household that they don't talk to you about. About how we're establishing trust with children. And, you know, we mentioned it, you know, even with the empty threats, it erodes trust. And when you do that, there are so many unintended consequences that happen as a result. And then also too, another thing that I want people to think about is that especially in that five to younger age group, that their brain is developing so much, and it is such a crucial time for brain development that hitting your child is potentially creating trauma in your child, which is potentially, which is going to impact the way that their brain develops, which is going to impact them throughout their entire lives.
Their emotional intelligence, their actual, like their IQ, all of that is affected.
Right.
Tiffany says she noticed there's an uptick in the style since COVID has started. I think it's also prevalent to the stressors outside of the behavior, because we have all this more stress packing on. And we were just talking about this before we started recording, that like our lives are so busy and we keep piling things on, but we still have to be in control of ourselves and not take that anger and that stress out on our children. And this is one of my favorite quotes. It's from Dr. Becky Bailey, who does conscious discipline. Discipline is not something we do to children. It's something we develop within them. So we don't want to do something to them for them to stay off the railroad track. We want to develop discipline within them so that they know we don't go on the railroad track and other, you know, behaviors that we want to teach them about.
Right. Right. And there's so many ways to really, there's so many ways to teach that, that are so much more powerful and more productive than hitting your child. Right. You know, you can even do, you know, you can do role play with your child. You can even watch shows. You can read books. You can simply, you can talk to them. You can watch, you know, videos talking about the consequences. And if you really do need to, if the choice is reading a book about a child who died, and, or, you know, reading something that's actually physically hitting your child, choose reading about that extreme.
When I made that extreme example, I was like, maybe not for 2-year-olds, but I'm talking like if your teenager won't stay off the railroad tracks, maybe read a news article about it so they realize the seriousness of it. Like, don't do morbid things to your 2-year-old.
2-year-old and 4-year-old
are, know your developmental level. Yeah.
They're not listening to like news articles anyways. but we can move on, but I just want to like be clear and end it with saying that, you know, creating trauma in your child is not the answer, because that is essentially what, you know, those comments are, you know, asking, create trauma. I want to create trauma so that, because it's the only way that I can teach my child not to, you know, go into the street. And then also, too, if your child is 2 years old, then you're going to also be very mindful, because they are very impulsive, you know, beings. They are very impulsive people. So you're going to be very mindful about the situations that you're putting them in, and what you can do in that situation. And then, and even that's also a potential time to redirect and to have them focus on, if you're busy with something for a moment and you're like unbuckling something out of the car, and you know, give them something to put in their hand that they can like focus, the squeeze, some kind of sensory thing too, just so like that's another tool for you, because you know you're busy and maybe you got like, you know, 2 kids, and so that's something, that's a tool that you can use so they can focus on that, because 2-year-olds are very present. The reason they're running in the street isn't because, more times than not, isn't because running the street is fun. It's because, ooh, like I'm excited and I'm moving towards something. So if you give them something else to kind of move towards and to focus on, then that street is more likely not even a thought. And even things like singing songs can be effective too, to have, keep their mind focused on something else in that moment while you're gathering, you know, your purse or whatever out the car.
I want to mention one more thing, just in case this helps.
Wait, go ahead.
Wait, are we helping Tiffany or no, helps Nicole. So one thing that I have seen too is kids who know that they're not supposed to go in the street, they're aware that's the expectation. This kid's 4, so she knows this is an expectation. They might be doing it. Their functional behavior might be like making a, shoot, did I cut out again?
I can still hear your audio.
Okay, sorry. They might be making a game out of it. They might be being like, oh, what's mom gonna do? Kind of pushing that boundary again. But also like if you say, oh, I said don't go in the street, and they go in the street and you don't do anything about it, then they're gonna keep like one time I had a parent be like, my child thinks it's so funny to run in the street. And I'm like, so what do you do every time they run in the street? Well, I run after him and say, don't run in the street. And I'm like, okay, you have to have a neutral response instead of having a positive or even a negative response. They're looking for that impact. They're a small child. They're trying to make an impact. If they make it, they're going to see what else they can do to make an impact. But if you just pick them up, if they're, you know, small enough, pick them up with a neutral affect and just kind of walk away, not bringing huge attention to it, and then talk to them about it in a different moment later, then you're not making it a game and reinforcing it.
Mm-hmm. And one
figure out the function.
Yeah. One last thought I'd like to throw in there that I like always say is that tell them what to do instead of what not to do too would be more effective in that moment. I know that's a safety thing too. And I say, reserve the no, stop, don't for like extreme, but like even if you're proactive, if you're getting your child out the car and you say, don't run in the street. Now they're thinking about running in the street. They may not have been thinking about that originally, but if, you know, you're getting them out the car and you're like, you know, fill this squishy ball or, oh, look, you know, here's your,
yeah,
you know, toy.
Let's hop all the cracks on the sidewalk, or give them like a game to like get them going on some activity.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Back to the, you know, and that is relevant to the power struggles. So I'm glad that it was able to be touched on, and I will just refer people who commented to this podcast. So that will be great. And I think we kind of touched on it, but I just mentioned it too a little bit, like how can we be proactive ahead of time and avoid power struggles so that it doesn't, you know, these power struggles, you know, don't occur as often?
Yeah. So I think you just barely like nailed a huge strategy right on the head. The redirection thing, giving them something to hold, giving them a game, being like, hey, why don't we like pick flowers today on our walk? So they're on this side of the road instead of on this side of the road. So being proactive by focusing on that redirection, knowing they might do this, so let's redirect them with this before they even think about doing the other thing. But some other things that I talk about when I talk about power struggles is having routines so they know what to expect every single day at the same time. Yeah. So like bedtime, if it's always a struggle, but they know we brush our teeth, we, you know, read a book, we do this, we go to bed, and that becomes a routine every night, then it's going to be less and less of a struggle because it's part of their routine. Or they wake up in the morning, they get dressed. If sometimes they wake up, they get to watch 2 hours of TV, and sometimes they get to wake up and they just get to play in their jammies all day, and then it's hard to get them dressed, consider getting in a routine every morning of getting dressed first thing, and that's going to take away some of those power struggles. The other thing is asking them questions. It kind of goes back to the two positive choices I talked about earlier. Like, first of all, give them two positive choices so you get the end goal that you want, but you've given them two ways to get to that end goal. So I always use the example of like getting in the car, but cleaning a room. If you're like cleaning a room, you'd be like, okay, do you want to clean up the blocks first or do you want to clean up the cars first? You didn't say, okay, it's time to clean up, let's clean up. You said, do you want to do this or this? Now they have a choice and it's still getting to the end goal. It's not a choice and a threat. It's two positive choices. So do you want to clean up in your bunny suit or do you want to clean up in your tiger suit? And then you can get and dress up and, you know, be creative. But then the last one is asking them questions. So if you're at grandma's house and you have to leave in 15 minutes, you can be like, oh, hey, Johnny, in 15 minutes, we have to go. How much more time do you need on your blocks? 5 minutes or 10 minutes? And they tell you how much time they need. And then you set the timer instead of you saying, in 5 minutes, we're going to go. If you have some flexibility, ask them what they need. And then they can be more responsive to, you know, it's time to go when it's time to go because they made that choice.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. Asking them what they need. And they really do feel very, you can even see it in their face when they make that choice. They feel very proud to make a choice when you are asking them 5 minutes or 10 minutes. They're excited to say, little do they know. And I used to refer to it as like, you know, back in the day, I used to refer to it as like Jedi mind tricking them. But, you know, it's But now I really look at it as it's a game that I always try to play of, because I know power struggles are just a thing with this age, is that, you know, how much power can I give you? Like, how much power can you handle before it's too much? And, you know, it's, you know, you don't have the ability maybe to, you know, to hang your jacket up or to put it on by yourself or to, you know, and if you don't have the ability to, oh, wow, great. A fun new thing for me to teach you. Great. And so, yeah, I really do like that. Now I have one more question and then we can wrap it up, Lauren. Sometimes there are situations where, you know, it's kind of a two-part question. I think I have two questions left. Sometimes there are times where, actually, I'm just going to, like, so let's say bedtime, right? Mm-hmm. Routine, we have our same routine every day, but now it is bedtime and now we do the same thing every day, expectations of communicating a variety of ways. But now we're closing the door and, you know, maybe they're not asleep. And then maybe, you know, 5 minutes later, you hear the, like, you know, the knocking or the mom or the, right. And they're like, I don't want to sleep. Like, I want to be up and play and be with you. You know, like, what do you do there? Because there's a lot less choice now, yeah. because it's bedtime and now there's only, you know, there are still some choices, but the child tends to be very aware of what choice you want them to make. And so I think kind of during like a nap time or bedtime, sometimes they'll try to be a little bit more savvy because it's like, this is the same thing every day. You just want me to go to sleep, don't you?
Yeah. For real. Okay, so I actually kind of covered this in my next week's podcast episode. So it's kind of fresh on my mind, but the topic of my podcast episode is don't ignore the junk behavior, because there are some, you know, parenting specialists or whatever people who say just ignore the junk behavior, and then I'll read the blog and it's like, if they do this or this or this, just ignore them or walk away or turn your back. And I'm like, how is that going to help your relationship if you just walk away when your kid needs something? You know, like I go on and on about what you can do instead, and a lot of these same strategies come up: redirect, figure out what they need. Anyways, for the one about bedtime, what I talked about is maybe our kid will come out and we take them back in, and then they'll just cry in their room or something like that. If we just ignore it, then sure, maybe they'll stop crying, but they're going to be in there feeling really sad and scared and all of these feelings, and we're not figuring out like what they need. So obviously this first time it happens, we kind of are going to have to spend more time in there, like maybe lay by them till they fall asleep. But then if we can figure out what they need, we incorporate that into their bedtime routines. So if they come out every single night and say, I need a drink of water, or hey, I didn't do this today, or hey, you forgot to lay by me, then put 10 minutes of laying by them, put a drink of water, and put this into their bedtime routine. So all of those things they come out for are already done. And then, like, if that isn't enough and they still come up with more excuses, then maybe they're communicating that they're afraid to be alone, that they're afraid of the dark. I personally, when I was a child, I had a lot of anxiety at night that like my mom was gonna die. I don't think I told anyone this, but I would just go take a pillow and just lay on the floor in my mom's room, and then I would be calm, and then I would just go back to my room when I was feeling like safe. So for me, I'm really sensitive to like the bedtime issue, because sometimes kids are communicating a need that they're not gonna express out loud, but they need support from you in whatever way that looks like. And I'm not saying your kid needs to sleep with you till they're 12 years old, but there are other ways to support them emotionally, even if they're not communicating those out loud.
So you've been dark your whole life. It's
I, yeah.
Where did that, Where did that? So you mentioned were you sleeping in your mom's room too? You were
so, No. I was little. I remember what house it was in, so I know it was before I was. Well, I was probably before I was 10, so like maybe 8. I was probably still doing when I was 8.
Do you know why? Like what you know may have sparked that thought?
You know, I just kind of have like an anxious personality. I handled it really, really well as a child. I was diagnosed with it in college. But one of the things I was super anxious about too was like, I wouldn't ride the bus because someone threw up on the bus and I was puke phobic. So then every time I was anxious about something, I would get a stomach ache. So then every single time I felt like I was going to throw up when I was anxious. And so it was just like this cycle that like ate at me like my whole childhood. But I never like,
that's the worst.
I have an episode coming up on anxiety too, but anyways, yeah, I was just like triggered by little things and then I'd get worried and then I would just lay in my mom's room. And honestly, my parents made us listen to this super, super creepy bedtime music. And later in our adult life, like the song would come on and me and my sister were twins and we always shared a room. So like, it wasn't like that I was sleeping alone. Anyways, we talked about it and we're like, that made us think our parents were gonna die. Like that song in my womb. It's like so yeah, so I think that's probably part of it. It's just like creepy music. It was dark.
Yeah. You know, and that's interesting too, you know, off on another topic, but I do think about like even I often think about the very little things that we put into a child's environment and how they're processing it. Because I do remember processing things like really weirdly sometimes as a child. Like I have some like weird memories of when I was, you know, 3 and 4 and 5 of thing. Like I'd hear a word or two and think it meant something completely different. And I think about that and I don't even remember telling anyone, and I honestly can't even think of an example right now, but I've just reflected on it before. And, you know, so I think about that, like when they're having anxiety or when I'm trying to figure out what the function of their behavior is, and I'm really just looking, sometimes I look a little too deep into it, but sometimes I look just deep enough to where it does actually, you know, maybe I ask the right question or bring up the right thing, and then there's a conversation, then they're able to process it, and then we're able to move on. I actually had a child who he was a super smart. So when we were talking earlier about developmentally, children can be in different places. I had a child who was developed cognitively super advanced. He came into my Montessori classroom of 3 to 5 year olds and he was able to read already. And honestly, his parents didn't even tell us. Like I wish they had warned us, because like at first I didn't even believe that. I just remember reading something, like it was like a circle time and I was reading something. And then he's pointed to a word. I think he pointed to a word and he said, I think he pointed to weather. And I was like, like that two syllable word that like, it doesn't, if you sound it out, it doesn't even make sense. And like, I had to kind of like test, like, and I showed him other words, like, and like, I was like going to my assistant. I'm like, hey, like this kid can read, like he can read, like how come? Anyways, this same child who social emotionally, he had a really hard time with a lot of things. One of the things being anytime someone would turn on the water, he would freak out. Anytime someone turned on water, he would freak out. And I don't mean like freak out like, wow, what's that? I mean, he would like grab his head and then run around and hide. And like he ended up like, it became like a safety hazard because he ended up actually really hurting himself one time because he was freaking out so much and like running around and really hurt his head. He hurt his head on the shelf and made a pretty good knot, but he was still worried about the water. He wasn't worried about the fact that he had his head. And through talking to him, and it took me a while, like this was a big thing in the classroom for like a week or two. And I'm like, I was racking my brain trying to figure out like how to help him, like just talking to him and just, and trying to help like the other kids. And you imagine, so you worked in a preschool before. So you know how much, and it's a full classroom with 20 kids.
Yeah.
How much the water gets turned on. We're watching our hands for everything, right? You know, before lunch, you know, before all the three meals of the day.
After,
you know,
sensory table, after outside.
Right, right. It is constantly, when someone decides they're going to play in some water, like it is constantly, you know, when someone puts their finger up there, it's constant, right? So, you know, at first, like while I was trying to figure out, I was talking to the, you know, I talked to the rest of the class and just acknowledged, like, you know, he has a really hard time when the water's on. So like, just turn on just a little bit. Just a little bit. And like, I had to like, I would try to strategically have him like in a different part of the room while everyone else was washing their hands, and then have him. And he didn't really like washing his hands much either, but over time, through observation, through like really looking, first thing I identified, I was like, okay, it's the sound. It's the sound. He's triggered by the sound. And then I figured it's not really the sound. It's the fact that like the water was on. And so I had to, one, bring in books, and like, cause he loved books, and like, cause like, again, he could read, yeah. He loved books. And it kind of sparked a conversation. I just kind of sat next to him. And actually this was over the course, cause I tell you, like, it was the main thing I was focused on for like 2 weeks straight. I was just sitting next to him and talking to him and kind of just like recounting the story of just kind of like, you know, like what happens, like when the water turns on, and like how he feels uncomfortable, he feels upset, and then I talk about emotions and kind of asking questions. And then he told me, and then like he finally, like he was able, you know, something I said or like a book that we had brought, like had inspired him enough to talk about what the problem was. And his problem was that we were wasting water.
Oh.
Right, right.
Which
makes sense, because in the program, in the Montessori program that I was in, we did talk a lot about how, you know, we talked a lot about the world, not everyone had access to water, and that, like, you know, we're grateful that we have water, but like, and we had like a book, and then I don't know if you're, you know, there is the Water for Life Foundation that we raise money for. We talked to the kids about, and we have, there's a little book, and you know, it's Amani Mon is the name of the foundation, and they have this little book where it shows people in Africa and how they have to walk miles, you know, to get off, to get, you know,
poor kid,
right? And so I figured it out, then we were able to talk and have conversation. I'm like, well, we're using it, and it's different. So we have, you know, validated, yeah, you're right, like we shouldn't be wasting water, but we're using water, right? There's a difference, right? We're using it because we need to keep our hands clean, like it's essential, it's important that we use water. We have to use water. And we talked about all the different uses for water and like why it's important and why we need water and what we use the sink for, and kind of compromise with them and just making sure that like, hey, like we're going to make sure that we don't waste water in the classroom. And we talked about it. And then over time, after we talked about it, maybe it didn't change right away, but I think by, you know, the third day of us talking about it, it did start to, like, he started to not be bothered by it as much. And then not bothered by it at all. And then it evolved into other conversations of, you know, now then people were using paper, and he's like, you're waiting, you know, now you're wasting paper. And then the printer was an issue but it wasn't a big issue because I kind of already understood, and we could talk about that. Like, okay, well, we're using it, and it's, you know, there's a difference. Yeah. And
can you imagine if you ignored it, or if you were his parent and you just spanked him when he did that or whatever, like instead of getting to the root of it? That's why we get to the root of the behavior.
And it took a lot of work. It was very inconvenient for me, 100%. But the rest of the year went by. And there were other challenges that, you know, because it was social, emotionally, like, you know, there was other, but that was no longer an issue. And we really did develop a lot of like trust and really like a strong bond. I would say is now I'm actually still like friends with his mom and like still, you know, we still talk on my Facebook friends and everything like that. But yeah, if we would have just, you know, punished for it, then that would have created trauma and maybe even exacerbated the issue. And then he wouldn't have learned from it. And then the other thing too, is we wouldn't have developed this trust to solve all these other problems that ended up coming up, you know, throughout the year that he definitely felt, he felt like he could trust me to talk to me. So many of the other problems that came out, he articulated himself a lot more because he felt like he knew that I was going to be there to help him and actually work with him and compromise. And sometimes, and realistically, he's right. Sometimes we were wasting water. We were wasting paper. And it actually, you know, it actually prompted me to be a little bit more mindful of how we used things in our room, because my mentality with the water, and honestly, my mentality with the water and the paper is that like, and like, and they made me grow a little bit. My mentality was that, you know, this is stuff that the company is providing. Yeah,
buys it. Janitor fills it up. We're good.
Right. Right. You know, like this is, yeah, this is, you know, it's all part of the learning, right? Like, so if you want to play with water, we want to use like extra water, like it's all part of the learning. So like, I wasn't really mindful of it at all. And he actually really taught me to be more mindful of it and have more conversation about it in the classroom. And also the other children in the room as well. And so it's, you know, it's not only the children who can grow. And I think I mentioned this a little bit earlier in the podcast. It's not only the children who can grow from us being curious about their behaviors. And I think the whole point in me telling the story is that I would have never made the connection that the, you know, Amani Mom, Water for Life Foundation, the book that was in, and I don't even think I talked about it that much in the classroom. I think and maybe it was something that I said, or maybe it was something that he read. But I would have never thought that that was the reason why he was like really freaking out every time we turned on water and like just really having a hard time with that. So really get curious, and it can be a really great experience. And, you know, the emotions that children have are not bad, really. They're all opportunities for learning, for growth. Now, Lauren, Lauren's probably about to log back on, but we're about to wrap up. And the way we're going to wrap up is I want Lauren to say just any last thing that you want to say to anyone out there that in terms of power struggles, or really anything that you think will be helpful for parents, teachers, nannies, anyone who's interacting with children.
Okay. So, well, I appreciate you having me on. I think it was really just a good in-depth conversation, and we can bounce off each other really well, which I really like. But I think the story you just told is powerful to me, because we can learn so much from our experience with children. And our whole goal in life is to get through new experiences using the information we gained from our previous experiences. And that's what we want to help our children do too. And so we all have different lenses, all have different experiences, and we need to keep our minds open and learn from our children and learn from our struggles and learn from our mistakes. And not just have this rigid view on, I'm an adult now, I've arrived, I'm going to be right. But it's like, we're all growing together. And I think that will help us avoid a lot of the power struggles.
Yes, we're all growing together. We're all on this journey together. And we may be a little bit farther along in our journey as adults, but we're still helping them on their journey. And in that process of helping and guiding them on their journey, they're really secretly helping us on our journey too. Cool. Beautiful.
Love it.
Thanks for coming on, Lauren. Follow her podcast too. It's XO Parenting, right? Or XOXO?
Yep. XO Parenting.
XO Parenting. It's great. I think I was on one of the first
Episode three, first guest interview.
Episode three and three is my favorite number, so that's perfect. So you can even see a little bit of me there if you want to kind of transition into her podcast. But also, my for those who are watching live right now, my podcast is also on Spotify, Apple, and all the other places, and so is Lauren's. Always a pleasure talking to you, Lauren.
Yeah, it's been great. And thanks for all the comments, everybody. It's super helpful to the conversation.
Yeah, and we gotta talk more. I very much just enjoy your being, Lauren, and I would love to, even if it's not a podcast, I'd just love to have more conversations
with you. For sure.
Different capacities, but that's a personal conversation. I'll see you guys next time, guys. Have a great week.
Goodbye.
Bye.
What's my name? What's my name? What's